Hello and welcome back to the Best of Women's Fiction podcast. I'm Ashley Hasty, the book blogger behind hastybooklist.com, a college fashion and marketing instructor, an aspiring author working on a historical fiction manuscript, and as of November of last year, a new mom. This is my first season back following my maternity leave, and I'm very excited about the lineup of authors we have for you. Without further ado, let's see who's up next. In this episode, Brenda Janowitz and I chat about her latest novel, The Audrey Hepburn Estate, a book Kristen Harmel, New York Times bestselling author of The Book of Lost Names, described as a complex family tale of love and deception. Brenda Janowitz always delivers delightfully complicated stories that leave me with tears in my eyes and hope in my heart. You won't want to miss this book about a woman and her two childhood loves and, of course, the estate where it all took place. Brenda, welcome to the Best of Women's Fiction podcast. I did some internet sleuthing and we've been Instagram friends since 2020 with the release of the Grace Kelly dress, and I've been such a fan ever since. I'm very excited to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here. And I love that you looked that up. That's something I would have done.
I am excited to chat with you about your latest novel, The Audrey Hepburn Estate. So let's start off, if you'll tell our listeners what the book is about.
Absolutely. Inspired by the Audrey Hepburn film Sabrina, The Audrey Hepburn Estate is the story of a woman who returns to the Long Island home where she grew up once she learns that it's set to be demolished. Going home again brings two men from her past back into her life, forcing her to reconsider everything she thinks she knows about her past. A little romantic, a little mysterious, it's ultimately a story about the true meaning of home.
Well, as I mentioned, the first book that got me hooked on you as a writer is The Grace Kelly Dress. I'm going to call that the beginning of a trend of classic celebrities and the things they own. Following Kelly, there was the Liz Taylor ring and now the Audrey Hepburn estate. So tell me a bit about how this trend got started.
First of all, I love that. I love everything about what you just said. Yeah, it is sort of the beginning of a trend for me. And the other day I called it a trilogy, but it's not, because all of these characters are completely separate. So the thread running between these three books is the Hollywood starlet and, as you said, something they own, the heirloom item. And it's funny when you say like the dress, then the diamond, then the house, I had to just like keep getting bigger. So now the heirloom item is enormous. It's like an entire estate. As for how I got started, you know, they always say you should write about the things that you're obsessed with. And since I was a little girl, I was always obsessed with these old Hollywood stars. On Sundays, I would watch old black and white movies with my mom. They used to always have them on repeat. And these were the starlets that I was sort of obsessed with. So for the Grace Kelly dress, I knew I wanted to write a book about a wedding dress. Actually, the connection to Grace Kelly came a little after. I started writing the proposal, and as I was describing the wedding dress, I, of course, took inspiration from the most iconic wedding dress of all time, my most favorite thing, the thing that actually inspired my own wedding dress, which is Grace Kelly's gown. And so the original title of that was Rose Point Lace, because that was one of the types of lace that was used on the gown. And my agent, I remember she said, you know, it's fine. The title's just not that great. We need a better title. And so I was like, well, why not call it the Grace Kelly dress? And so she said, oh, I love the title, but why? Why is it called that? And I was like, well, because the dress I'm describing. And she had no idea what Grace Kelly's wedding dress looked like. And to me, I was like, doesn't everyone know what that looks like? So I sort of went from there. And then I just sort of layered more and more in, and I made it more intentional that it was a copy of Grace's dress, and that way I was able to sort of like infuse it with more of Grace Kelly and princess stuff and sort of things about her movies and her life. And that's when the trend just sort of started. So I did Liz Taylor next because I knew I wanted to write about an heirloom piece of jewelry, because I'm obsessed with jewelry. Because again, you know, you stay with these books for so long, you do have to be obsessed with your topic. I love jewelry that's been handed down. And I felt like that was like a natural next step from a wedding dress. As for Audrey, you know, by then I was sort of like a well-oiled machine with all of my research. So as I was writing, I was buying all of my research books and starting to look into her life. And as is the case with Grace Kelly and Elizabeth Taylor, I thought I knew everything there was to know. And it turned out I knew barely a thing. There were so many things. that I learned about Audrey Hepburn's life. Even, you know, rewatching her films as an adult, I find like as you rewatch these films at different stages of your life, you sort of take them in differently. So I had so much to learn about Audrey. Like, for example, I did not know she was a homebody and loved home and how important that was to her. Once those details started coming into focus, that's when I realized what the book should be.
For the Grace Kelly dress, you said the dress sort of came first, and then Grace Kelly came later. For the Liz Taylor ring and the Audrey Hepburn estate, did the celebrities come first, or did the story sort of come first and you fit the celebrity that fit the story you wanted to tell?
Well, a little bit of both, actually, because in terms of the starlets that I'm obsessed with, it's definitely Grace Kelly, Elizabeth Taylor, and Audrey Hepburn. The item definitely came first for Liz Taylor because I knew I wanted to do jewelry. And then once I started thinking about jewelry, there's no other Hollywood starlet you think of than Elizabeth Taylor. So they sort of like were together from the start, and that one was easy. Audrey was a little different. I knew the movie I wanted to focus on was Sabrina. And the more I thought about it and when I rewatched it, I was sort of like, I think I need a love triangle also. I just sort of like kept getting deeper and deeper into Sabrina. When I learned that Audrey Hepburn was a homebody and loved home, I was like, oh, this is perfect. You know, everything, all of the research, everything I learned about her, it all sort of like fell into place. So Audrey also, it sort of like happened at the same time, but just very luckily because I'm obsessed with Audrey and I'm obsessed with the concept of home. I'm a homebody as well, so I had a lot to say about that. They sort of all fall together.
Taking a step back for a minute, I love asking authors how they became authors. Their journeys to publication are often varied. You started as a lawyer, so tell me about your journey from lawyer to novelist.
It's so funny because sometimes people are so surprised that I was a lawyer first. I mean, I'll take it back to my childhood, actually, because I was always one of those kids who loved to read and loved to write. I can remember just being like a little girl, always being obsessed with reading. When I was younger, my parents would take me to bookstores and I could just sort of like run around and buy whatever I wanted. And books were always a very, very big part of my life. But I think when I was younger, I didn't know that you could just be an author. Like, I didn't think that was a thing that was possible. It felt like this dream. So I loved to read. I loved to write. I became a lawyer. But I was one of those lawyers who hated being a lawyer. And I shouldn't say that. You know, I loved law school and I loved being at my firm. I loved working with a lot of really intelligent people who sort of knew what was going on in the world. I loved that part. I didn't love working till like 9 and 10 every night. That part I definitely did not love. And then I clerked for a judge, but I was still in New York, so the hours were still kind of crazy. And I just couldn't like find my place. So I always say I was one of those lawyers who was walking the halls thinking of the stories she wanted to write. When I was turning 30, my best friend got together with a bunch of my friends and they did a group gift for me. And that was to send me to a writing class. Because one of my excuses, of course, was that's sort of when things really took off for me. Tuesday nights were dedicated to the art of writing. I took it really seriously. While I was in that class, I started writing what would become my first novel. At that point, I think my goal was just, okay, I'm turning 30. I want to just write a book. If I just write a book, I'll be satisfied. Like, that's all I want to do. But, you know, you're a type A lawyer. So you finish the book and you're like, well, now I should just get it published, right?
Definitely.
So I did.
I know quite a few writers who started out as lawyers, so I'm wondering, do you think there is something about law or law school that helps you in your writing career?
I do, actually. I do. There are so many. I actually did a listicle a few years back about lawyers turned writers. And now the list, I mean, if I tried to name them all, there's just like too many to name. I do think there's something to that. I think a lot of people become lawyers because they love to read and love to write. But I will also say law school teaches you to sit for hours on end, reading, writing, researching. So much of the skills that you sort of become accustomed to as a lawyer transfer. So, you know, they always say with writing, it's like butt in chair. You have to like really just like sit down and do the work. And that's what it was like being a lawyer. You know, whatever the assignment was, if it was a brief, if it was a document production where you had to read millions of papers, like whatever it is, you had to sit down and do it. That's a lot of writing a book. Like there are days where you'll come to the computer and you just feel like you have absolutely nothing to say, but you have to write anyway.
Well, Audrey Hepburn Estate is your 8th novel. Many authors, myself included, would dream of a career like yours. What one piece of advice would you share with writers who are at the beginning of their careers?
Oh God. I never know what to say. I feel like I used to have really good advice, but it's I feel like the further I get along in my career, the less I know, if that's possible. It's like the more you get to like learn how the sausage is made, you're just like, ah, so much of writing. I feel like writers don't say this enough. So much of writing is luck and being in the right place at the right time and fairy dust. You know, especially me being a lawyer. To become a lawyer, it's like you go to law school, you study for the bar. If you study for the bar, you will pass. But just because you write a book, and just because you write a good book, it doesn't mean anyone's going to write it. Like there's that fairy dust component of it. So I think that's why I always find it so hard to give advice. But recently, a college student asked me to make a video with advice. So I'll give you the advice I gave these college students. Writing is rewriting. So for me, 8 books in, what I'm realizing, and this really started with the Grace Kelly dress, actually, the most important part of your writing is the editing. I feel like when you're writing your first book, you feel like it's like this momentous thing, right? You've written a book, you've 300 pages. For me, it took me a full year. It feels like every sentence is perfectly placed and nothing can move, but writing is rewriting, and the good stuff comes in those edits. When I was doing the edits, one timeline, I completely ripped out and rewrote for the second draft. And at the time, I remember thinking, like, I can't do this. Like, there's no way I can rewrite an entire timeline, especially because so much had been like woven in from the other two. But it wasn't working. And it was one of those things, you know, forgive the pun, but once you pull one thread, sometimes the whole thing falls apart. And that's what had happened with that timeline. My editor made like the tiniest little note. It was that the protagonist wasn't active enough. She wasn't making enough decisions. Like her best friend was sort of guiding things. And that's like a cardinal sin. I mean, the book is about your protagonist. She can't just be sitting around letting life happen. So once she pulled that string, I was like, oh God, this whole thing is wrong. So I rewrote the whole thing with her other notes in mind. Ultimately, I think that's what made that a stronger book, that I allowed myself to just like completely tear it apart. It's hard when you're first starting. And I remember with my first novel, like I didn't want to change a sentence. I was like, no, I placed that there on purpose, as if my editor didn't know that. Like as if she thought I just did like a Mad Libs to create this book. But 8 books in, that's the biggest thing I've learned. And I think that's the thing that really makes your writing sing. It's on the edits and the digging that you start to uncover like life truths and the book really comes together.
I love that you pointed that out, that writing is rewriting. As an author early on in my career, unpublished, unagented, editing is the hardest part for me. Like, I could write a million first drafts and never actually go back and edit any of them because that's the hard part. But that's also where a good book is made. That's why it's hard.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I'm very similar to you. Right now, I'm working on like a first draft of something, and someone was saying, oh, that's the hardest part. I'm like, no, this is the best part. You have so much fun. You could do whatever. You know, if it doesn't work, you'll just get rid of it later. But when you're doing that first run through, you just sort of are going crazy with it. And I remember with the Liz Tayloring, I was writing that during COVID, during the very first summer of quarantine. And my brain, I just like could not focus. I didn't know what was going on. I was like, will we all live? Like, will we be alive when this book gets published? And I remember just going crazy, saying to myself, just write. If it's bad, you'll get rid of it. And there were so many times, like my agent was like, what is happening here? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. It was COVID. She's like, get rid of that. But, you know, it's the editing. You're like, oh, I'll edit it later. So to me, the like you said, the first draft is the fun stuff.
And I liked your analogy of pulling the thread. I think that's why I don't like editing, or that I resist editing, is that I'm afraid if I start pulling a thread, it will just all unravel in front of me and I'll be like, oh gosh, now what?
Yeah, I mean, I've been there so many times. I used to say, like, when friends would say, how's the editing? I would say, oh, I'm at that part where I've torn so much apart, I don't think I could put it back together again. And every writer would be like, oh, yeah, I know that part. Like, did you cry? Okay, once you've cried, now you can start to edit. But sometimes it just feels like, oh, God, I worked so hard on this, and now I've just torn it apart in a way that it can't be sort of redone. But it can, and you will. It's just really hard, but you will, and it'll be better for it. I feel like the other thing I do when I do a massive edit, I now save various versions. So I have like 6 or 7 incarnations of the same book because it's like tricking your mind. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to ruin this thing. And you say, okay, no problem. Then I'll just go back to the original. And almost every time, if you go back to the original, you're like, no, the new one's stronger. So, but like mentally, you have to have it there so that you can like trick yourself into rewriting. Mm-hmm. You're like, okay, if it's worse, I can always fix it. But 9 times out of 10, you're going to love the new stuff you've done. Cause also at that point, you know, the characters so much more and you know, you're just, you have like a deeper relationship with them and you understand what you're trying to say. I think when you're first starting to write, and for me on a first draft, you're like, what is this book about? And I remember saying this to one of the writers I was helping. I read either her book or something about, and I said, okay, so what's this about? And she was like, what do you mean? I just told you the plot. I'm like, no, not the plot. Like, what's the story? What's this about? Like, what's your point? And she was like, oh God. And so then after I said that, she's like, oh wait, now I'm looking at the book differently. And I think ultimately you do have to take that step back at a certain point and say, what is this book? That's for you. But when you edit it with that in mind, that's when you make it stronger. So like for Audrey, the book is about home, the true meaning of home. When you edit with that in mind, everything is leading towards that.
As our regular listeners know, my favorite part of the writing process is research. And I love hearing about how authors go about their own research process. So what does your research process look like for your books?
First of all, I just have to say, I'm fascinated. That's your favorite part. I feel like it's my least favorite part. I don't know. For me, it's such a way to procrastinate. Like I can go down a rabbit hole for weeks, just weeks on end. And it's like, well, I can't finish the book because I have these 10 phone calls out to these 10 different museums. So for me, for these three books in particular, I was writing as I researched. I know a lot of writers do like a year of research, then they jump into writing, but I'm just not one of those writers. I like to do a lot of free writing. I think that's why I have to edit really heavily because sometimes I'm just sort of like seeing what will happen. For this book, I started writing. I mean, originally she had a different profession. It took place somewhere different. Like she had a different name. Like everything about my protagonist changed once I learned more about Audrey Hepburn and I wanted to infuse more of her life and her films into my protagonist. But I just said to myself, just keep writing and you can always go back and change. And that's what I did. So for a long time, like the first chapter didn't match like the second half of the book because I didn't go back and change her. I was like, oh, I'll do that later. I'll do that later. So I was sort of researching as I went and that just works for me. The thing that you should always do is do whatever works for you. So for me, every book is different, every experience is different, and I just do whatever works. Like whatever will get the words down on the page, I think is a good thing.
Although your books are titled after starlets, the starlets are never your protagonist. The stories themselves focus on other characters. Do you do much research on the starlets themselves for which the books are named, or is your research more about the time period?
I do a ton of research on my starlets. I love that because sometimes people pick up the book and they don't read the back. And so they assume it's biographical fiction and it's not. The starlets are referenced and you will definitely get a lot of like Audrey Hepburn reading the book. So if you're a Sabrina fan, you will notice the black dress and the white and black dress from the film. Yeah, I do a ton of research on the starlets themselves. I feel like I want the book infused with their essence. For the Grace Kelly dress, I was trying to get the regal, the sort of like, well, for lack of a better word, the grace of Grace Kelly and the elegance. For the Liz Taylor ring, Elizabeth Taylor's life was incredibly scandalous. And I wanted the read to almost feel like a little scandalous, like anything could happen at any moment. For Audrey Hepburn, I don't know if you saw the documentary on Netflix, but one of the things her granddaughter said was the secret about Audrey Hepburn that no one knew was that she was sad. Yeah, that like broke my heart a little because I think a lot of us, and this is what the research taught me, like a lot of us think of her as a certain way and it's like her image from these films, you know, from the Oscars and stuff, like the elegant, chic woman in the beautiful black dress. But she was sort of like so much more than that and her life was so much more than that. I wouldn't call her life sad though. I mean, she had a lot of moments of joy. She was an independent, smart woman who really went for what she wanted and really knew what she believed in. She had also faced so much adversity in her life, which I did not know about. I had no idea that she survived 5 years of Nazi occupation in Holland as a child. From there, she suffered severe malnutrition, and I didn't know that either. And I think a lot of people don't know that because someone came up to me and said, so Audrey Hepburn, did she have an eating disorder? And I was like, that's what you take from her little like life figure that she had an eating disorder? I said, no, she didn't have an eating disorder. As a matter of fact, she loved eating, but she suffered severe malnutrition during the war, and it followed her through her whole life. Those health problems, unfortunately, followed her through her entire life till the end of it. So researching her, learning more about her, that helped me infuse the book with like the spirit of Audrey. So I wouldn't say it's sad, but there is like a thoughtfulness to it. So it's not as just, it's not just like all little black dresses, although there are little black dresses, but it's not all that.
Well, I did not know there was a documentary about her on Netflix, and I will definitely be going to look that up.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It has family members. It's just as fascinating for the family members it includes and the family members it doesn't include. The whole thing is really well done and interesting. It gives you a really good sense of her life, a little of everything.
Well, I'd love to hear about the books you're reading and loving right now. Can you tell us a bit about your reading world? What books should we not miss?
Ooh, well, obviously I love reading. I was the Pop Sugar Books correspondent for 5 years. And even though I no longer report on my books, I do love talking about books. But the funny thing is, when people would say, what are you reading? I used to say, oh, just go to this list. And then I would have all of my books. I no longer have that list, but I actually do keep this notebook with what I'm reading. I've, of course, completely forgotten. So I will tell you the things I've read recently. I just picked up Hell of a Book, which was a very big deal, like a year or two ago, and I just started it and I'm loving it. It's about this Black author and he's going on book tour. I'm looking up the author. It is Jason Ma. Already I can tell it's like really entertaining and clever, but I could tell it's like deeper. And I love books that you could read on like two different levels like that. I just finished Pineapple Street by Jenny Jackson. Everyone's talking about that one, so of course I had to read it. And that was like really fun. Actually, when I clerked for my judge, I worked in Brooklyn Heights, so I'm really familiar with the neighborhood she's talking about. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with that level of wealth that she's talking about, but I do aspire. And then before that, I read The Vacationers by Emma Straub, and I loved it. I love her writing. There's something so delicious about her writing and her characters. I'm really sort of like all over the place with my reading, I feel like. What are you reading?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. Nothing right now because I'm on maternity leave. That's not true. I'm reading kids' books. A lot of kids' books.
Oh, they're fun and it's hard to find like the right ones. Are you into the Sandra Boynton ones? Have you picked those up yet?
I haven't, no.
Oh, like Moo Moo, Ba La La. I'm probably butchering it, but you have to, they're cute board books.
Okay.
And your son will equally enjoy you reading it and him eating it because it's a cardboard board book. My kids, forgive the pun, devoured all of her books. They're so much fun and they're like fun to read. They like have these funny rhymes. I highly recommend.
I will definitely have to look those up. I think our favorite right now is like My Little Bookworm.
Cute.
Or I Love You Little Bookworm or something like that. We like to read that one. Mostly me. And he just like looks at the pictures.
I remember I used to always try to get reading done on late night feedings because I had friends. They were like, that's when I get all my reading done. But I was just like so exhausted, like half asleep, half awake. I never got reading done at that time.
Yes. I downloaded audiobooks because I heard that too. That would get through books during late night feedings if they were on audio, and it just never worked for me. I don't know, like holding him, feeding him, and juggling my phone and getting it to play and then stopping when he was fussing here, and it was just a mess.
I know, it's like getting in the right position, you're comfortable, he's comfortable, then you have to burp it. It's like, it never ends.
I couldn't get my brain to focus on what I was doing and also the book that was playing, so that did not work for me.
I know, it's tough. Soon you'll be at the stage where your baby will take longer naps. Of course, then you have to do laundry and the bottles. But if you have 5 minutes at the end of the 700 chores you have to do, that's a good time to.
Of course, I want to share how people can find you. So will you give us your website and where you like to hang out on social media?
Of course. My website's pretty easy. It's just brendajanowitz.com. So brendajanowitz.com. On social media, I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. But I spend most of my time on Instagram.
And before we wrap up, is there anything else you wanted to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
Ooh, I mean, I'm sure a million. I definitely want to talk about baby stuff now that I'm on with you, but I don't know if the listeners want to hear. I'm like, should I give you more baby book recommendations?
Yes, absolutely. When we end this recording, we'll make a list.
You're at like such an interesting time because I feel like when I had my first son, it was like, oh, and now you could do this, you could do that, you could do the other thing. But your days are so filled Like by the time it's time to go to sleep, you're so exhausted. You're just like boned. You know, the days are long, but the years are short. And you're definitely like in a rough spot in terms of having your job and trying to write, but you find the time. Somehow, miraculously, you'll find it. And the other thing I want to say, when you have a baby, it's really easy to get consumed in just baby world, like baby land, because you know, you are going to be exhausted and there is so much to do and you get it. But it's so important to have something for yourself. I remember at one point when I was pregnant with my second, I was really struggling to find the time, to find the energy, and even to find something like I wanted to say because my life was sort of so consumed with having this 2-year-old and being pregnant. And I remember I said to my husband, okay, I think I'm done with writing. Like, I'm just going to stop. I had a few books. That was a good run. I did great. And now I'm just going to be a mom and focus on that and just be like totally retired. And I remember he was like, that sounds like a terrible idea. We are going to get a babysitter a few times a week and you are going to write. I remember when I first started, it felt like so much pressure to get my writing done at that time. It was like an hour here, 2 hours here. Even if I had like a 3-hour block, it was like, go, 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 go. And the writing isn't always like that. In hindsight, I realized that that time was so incredibly important because you need something for yourself. It's very easy to get wrapped up in things, but you need to have something for yourself, know who you are, have this way to express yourself. So I think it's great, even with baby in the background somewhere, you're continuing to do your work and do your writing. I think it's all great.
Oh, that's so interesting that your husband said that too. My husband said something similar to me recently when I was like, I don't know if I can do this, if I can be a mom and do the blog and the podcast and write and keep reading for fun. And he's like, we will find the time. We'll figure it out.
Oh, that's so amazing. Oh, that makes me feel so good to hear that he said that. You know, not everyone is lucky enough to have that. So,
I know.
yeah.
And it's helping me to keep a bit of who I was pre-baby as well. Have some, like you said, have something for yourself.
It's very easy to forget all of that. I mean, it's only been a few weeks for you, but still, you can see how dramatically your life has changed and it just keeps going. And you don't want to wake up one day and sort of be like, who am I? Where did I go? Right?
For me, it happened so fast. I had these grand plans of like easing out of the blog into maternity leave, giving myself a few weeks before he was due. And then he was 6 weeks early. And so it was just, I was in the middle of like planning for maternity leave. And then he was here, and then everything stopped except for baby stuff. And now I'm starting to get back into blog stuff. And I'm like, do I remember how to do this?
I feel like you were so organized. So that's fascinating to hear that he like caught you unawares. It's like a good metaphor for mom life though, right? Because like as much as you plan, it's just life is what it is. And I feel like that's one of the lessons I learned as a mom. Just when you think you have everything under control. I remember like at one point I was complaining about something one of my kids was doing and my mom said, oh, don't worry, every stage ends. So like even if it's a good stage, like whatever your kid's doing, they're going to change soon enough, so don't worry. So life is constantly sort of changing and you're always readjusting. I guess that's good, right? It teaches us to sort of like move and edit more, right? All comes back to editing.
And we brought it full circle.
I love it.
Oh, Brenda, this was so fun. I cannot thank you enough for joining us on the podcast. You've been a wonderful supporter of my blog and now this podcast. And I'm
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
For links to the books mentioned in this episode, the author's social media, and more, visit bestofwomensfiction.com. You can also see the video version of this same episode. I'd love it if you'd follow me on Instagram at Ashley Hasty. You can also subscribe to the podcast right here, and if you enjoy it, please share with your friends.